So time for a few questions. Couple left over from yesterday, and then about, looks like five more. See what we get through. Could you talk about the time of the fires that came so close to the monastery? Yeah, just briefly, it was 2017, in October, I believe. Yeah, it was one of those times when California fires were rearing up. It was quite a significant one in the Bay, North Bay area. There were several of them that occurred at the same time, and one occurred just across, began in Potter Valley, which is one valley over from us. And because of high winds and very, very dry temperatures, it spread very rapidly over the hill and in this direction into Tomkai area of Redwood Valley. And basically, to make a week-long story condensed and short here, it came through the Tomkai Road area, pretty much wiped out some very large chunks of the area, and including the houses of several of our supporters and friends. Sandra's not here today, but she's a regular friend of ours, and her house was destroyed. All this was happening in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock in the morning, midnight, 2 a.m. And luckily, one of our monks, Tanchitapalo, happened to look out his window at that time and saw a huge wall of flame in the distance and alerted the community, and our community was able to evacuate in time. But we stayed evacuated. I wasn't here, and actually none of the three of us in the front were here. Ajahn Yanaka was still in Thailand, and Lungpa and myself were in New Hampshire. Anyway, there were still quite a crew here, all evacuated safely. We spent, and Lungpa and myself actually came back about 2 days after, I think, the fire started, or three, and joined the community, 2 days, and joined the community who were all sheltered at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. So we stayed on there for about a week. And luckily, the fire did come onto our property. It made it just as far as about maybe 50 feet or so from the B2 cabin. Somebody, I don't know who's staying in there now, but who knows, you know, whether it was a fate of nature or the devas were protecting us or a combination of both. But according to the firefighters who were on the property, the fire was advancing down the hill. It was still a fairly significant fire, but not quite as much of a firestorm as the first few hours. But then when it got just, you know, close enough to people were really concerned, the firefighters on the property, it decided to turn around and go back the other way. So we were very fortunate in that way, and that the property was essentially unaffected. Just one of our water tanks up on the ridge suffered a bit of damage. But pretty much we were left untouched, gratefully so. Sometimes when I meditate, I have a pleasant sensation similar to goosebumps or light massage on the back of the head, sometimes in one area and sometimes spreading like a ring around the head. It is not distracting and actually feels good. Sometimes I just let it be, and sometimes I observe it. Once I did that and it felt like liquid distilling and dripping inside the head. One time it lasted until the end of the session and I opened my eyes and there were tears. I would be grateful for your advice in understanding it. Well, I really don't have much of an idea about what might be going on. Just to say that, you know, when people ask these questions, our teachers, for the most part, Ajahn Chah and all of his disciples that I've ever heard talk about things like this, is that that many, many different kinds of experiences and sensations, and both physical and mental, perceptual, can occur in meditation. It's sort of like, well, you know, who knows why these things happen? They just do. And it's very tempting to try and think about it and analyze it and ask what the reasons are, and is this significant, and does this mean something, you know, or, you know, am I accomplished in some way, or am I not, or, you know, or is it just hallucinations, or what? People like to try and have an answer, figure something out as to what it is, where it comes from, what it means. And most of the time, the way that I've heard it answered is, don't think about it too much, don't worry about it, don't expect it. And particularly if it's a pleasant kind of experience, don't become attached to it, because it'll change. Just to keep concentrating on anicca, dukkha, anatta, no matter what the experience is, it's all part of the conditioned realm. What are the sufferings you still struggle with? What helps you deal with them, and why do you think you still struggle with those sufferings despite following the precepts in the Eightfold Path? Well, the sufferings that I still struggle with are greed, hatred, and delusion. Not necessarily in that order, but... and its various manifestations. I think one of the things that is commonly acknowledged is that in monastic life, where we've kind of greatly reduced our experiences in the sense realms and the temptations that come to us within sense desire, that the sufferings that we often still struggle with in monastic life are attachment to views and opinions. I can still see those surge up in my mind at times. And the reason that I would say probably all of us here, almost all of us here, struggle with these is because they're very, very entrenched, and it's what keeps us all in samsara over and over and over again. And that completely eliminating them is, of course, you know, the end result and what we would call liberation, complete liberation. And it takes a long time. But even following the precepts of a monastic form, you know, which is about as, you know, tight a container as you can have, learning the Eightfold Path, actually learning the Eightfold Path and fully realizing it are very different things. This is not a overnight kind of endeavor. This is a least lifetime endeavor for most people. For many of us, it will be, or has been, and or will be, a multi-lifetime path, just because we've all been doing this and reinforcing it and living it, living the lives of greed, hatred, and delusion from an inconceivable beginning, is the way that the Buddha puts it. We cannot possibly conceive of how long, how many lifetimes and eons that we've been involved rolling around in all of this and reinforcing the mental habits, the mental leanings that keep us going with our suffering. But with diligence and good effort, we can break that cycle. We can break that pattern, and just knowing that is and feeling quite. Quite inspired by the Buddha's teachings, because the little bits that I have been able to realize and put into practice and experience gives me a sense of faith that this is the way to let it all drop, if I can just hang in there and not get overwhelmed. And so can you. Why do you think we sometimes don't know what to do with our lives? Did you experience this before becoming a monk, and do you sometimes still do experience this? What helped you when you felt that way, if you ever did? Yeah, I did. But it's, you know, particularly before I became a monk, it took me quite a long time to make the decision to ordain. Even after being exposed to the monastic communities for many years, it wasn't easy to make that transition. And, you know, it's just, why do you think we sometimes don't know what to do with our lives? It's because we're just all confused. You know, we think that we'll find happiness and contentment and satisfaction in the realm of conditions. And it gives us enough positive feedback that we get fooled for a little while and think, ah, I finally got it. And it takes a little while to realize, oh, I didn't, after all. And we just keep on doing that. I mean, it's kind of like gambling, you know, that, you know, casinos and places of gambling, you know, make it so that they give you just enough feedback and you win just enough times that you think, okay, you know, I got it. Yeah, this is great. I'm on a roll. But, you know, the system is rigged. They, you know, the casinos, they know the odds and they're going to make a lot of money off of the aggregate. So, you know, life is generally like that. We get fooled by the appearance, and we think that's, we think we're going to win the big one, you know, if we just find the right, you know, angle, or the right sense experience, or the right whatever. That's Mara. Mara's got us that way. So it's just kind of relentless reevaluating all of that, looking at it, being honest with yourself, asking yourself the questions, is this really satisfying in the long term? Is this really gonna last? What's gonna happen, you know, tomorrow, the next day, when this experience fades, whether it's even a sublime spiritual experience that we attach to. And we think, ah, now I've got it. You know, whether it's that or in the sense realm or in our personal lives or our relationships, you know, we just have to be brave enough to ask ourselves the question, where will this end? Will it end? And it's just that kind of self, you know, honest self-questioning and being willing to do what it takes to step out of that. And I mean, it means it doesn't, I'm not trying to say it means you have to become a monastic, but you just have to have the motivation to make it a firm commitment to understand how you got here and how to undo the habits that keep you stuck and to commit to the path in whatever form works. Dear Ajahn, how does one practice wise sense restraint in lay life where one has to deal with family, friends, co-workers, and so on, especially on the level of speech and emotions that one encounters? Thank you. Well, it's the same in monastic life where one has to deal with family, friends, co-workers, and so on. We've got them all too. And it's a little bit, I mean, sense restraint is I think probably maybe the question also, it's not just sense restraint, but restraint of speech and action is kind of seems like where the question is pointing towards. Speech, especially on the level of speech and emotions that one encounters, because sense restraint, it does involve sense restraint, but sense restraint meaning what it is, how we attend to the world around us. Sense restraint not necessarily meaning shutting off the sense doors or closing one's eyes, closing one's ears, disappearing up into the forest, not paying attention to anything. Those can be some aspects of sense restraint when things are overwhelming, but sense restraint generally means not attending to those features of an experience or an object that are provocative of greed, hatred, and delusion, lust, desire, aversion. So knowing how to properly deal with sense data that comes in, how to view something that would normally be enticing to you or attractive to you or repulsive to you, how to see those sense objects or hear or experience, through any of the six sense doors, how to attend to them in a wise way that doesn't ignite or support those underlying tendencies towards desire or aversion. So looking at things more clearly and not letting the haze or the illusion fool you as to what it is that you're attending to or to letting in through the sense doors. So it's using wisdom to see, for instance, the unattractive and the attractive, or the elementality of that which might be repulsive, seeing things in their true form, their elements, their true nature, without letting the underlying tendencies of hatred or delusion or greed inform how what you attend to, what you look at. Because like to have to really be fooled by an attractive object, you have to be very selective about what you look at. And if you look too closely at everything, then you realize, oh, maybe that's not quite so enticing after all. So that's kind of what sense restraint really means. Again, it doesn't mean necessarily shutting oneself off. So it's just looking at it with what's called wise attention, yoniso manasikara. And then in the expressive level of restraint, I mentioned this, I think I was talking about this in a talk or Q&A sometime before, but particularly around speech, and that's something that we have to practice with every minute of the day here, essentially, with our family, friends, coworkers, and so on. It's a lot of it is just really developing that moment-to-moment mindfulness of what's going on inside. And if you feel, and it's a lot of it is based on body awareness, because all of our emotional states have some sort of expression in the body, and it's our most reliable source of information about what's going on in our mind as well. So if we want to know what's happening on an emotional level in our hearts and our minds, the more we fully attend to the body and its various ways that it registers these mental experiences, the more we're going to know when, say, an unskillful response is about to happen. So like, we have a difficult encounter with a co-worker or a family member or a friend, and if we're really, practiced and well attuned to our bodies, fairly quickly we see that kind of, emotion start to rise up and surge as like a cramping in the stomach or a tightness in the chest or a heat in the body. If there's like a lot of emotion, heat rises up, face flushes, So, or the hands get, something tenses up, and it kind of grabs. So the more we're aware of that, the more it's like, okay, there's a warning here. This is like, okay, if I act on this, if I say something in this state of body mind, it's quite possible that it's going to come out in an unskillful way and not be of any use to anybody, and that I'll regret it later. Exercising that kind of practice of mindfulness and clear comprehension, just as this is how we want to live our lives. This is the daily practice, whether we're sitting on the cushion or going about our daily business. And then practicing the restraint of the, particularly of the speech faculty. If you feel like you're about to say something in response to a difficult situation, and there's that sense of tension beneath all of it, then sometimes the most skillful thing to do is to skillfully and politely excuse yourself and withdraw from the situation until the emotion inside of you has settled down to a point where you can respond in a way that's going to be useful. The Buddha prescribed a certain number of conditions that one should meet before one, gives somebody some feedback or responds in some way. And honesty, of course, is at the foremost, but also knowing the usefulness of it. Sort of like what I'm going to say not only be the truth, but is it going to be actually useful to this person? Are they going to take it in the right way and be able to use it in a way that is going to be helpful? And to do it with a heart of kindness as best you can. And knowing the right time, the right place. You don't do it in front of a group of other people or in front of other, friends, family members. Try and find a quiet place where there can be a bit more ease and trust. Knowing the right time, is this person in a state of mind that they'll be able to hear what it is that I have to say? So there's a lot of conditions for practicing right speech when the emotions are running high. I've done it before, and the more I do it, the more I appreciate it, so that if I'm feeling, like a little bit charged with something, it's okay to say, well, I'm not ready to talk about this yet. I think I'll, leave right now, and then perhaps we can get together again and talk about this, when I'm in a clearer state of mind. And just to be able to say that gently and then withdraw and then kind of let it process through you. Okay. Is it possible that someone is following the Eightfold Path without being aware it is the path laid out by the Buddha? For example, it seems conceivable to me that, and in parentheses, without reading the Eightfold Path, so it sounds like a person isn't quite sure what the Eightfold Path involves. For example, it seems conceivable to me without reading the Eightfold Path, somebody could somehow figure out putting in effort to increase wholesome thoughts, actions, and effort to decrease unwholesome thoughts and actions is the kind of effort they want to put in, but never realizing what they are doing is, quote, right effort from the Eightfold Path. Could someone like this attain Nibbana? It's conceivable that could be the case, but usually that's what we would call the Buddha, or a Pacheka Buddha, someone who without getting any kind of instruction or associating with people who have followed this particular path, it's a very rare event that a being appears in the world that can really has parami, the goodness, the merit, the years of preparation, the lifetimes of preparation to be able to discover and practice the Eightfold Path to Nibbana without a teacher. or without some sort of instruction or connection to other beings who have done that. And that's like, you know, the Buddha of our age, the Shakyamuni Buddha, self-realized or self-enlightened Buddha, he did do that. And there are, you know, examples of what they call Pacheka Buddhas, which aren't fully, they're not Sammasambuddhas, Buddhas, like the Gotama the Buddha, where they actually establish a dispensation and teach and establish a monastic order, and they're more solitary. But they are also self-realized. Very, very, very rare. So yes, it is possible theoretically, but very, 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 very rare. I don't know if I said enough varies there. So, you know, we're lucky, though, that we don't have to worry about that, because we've got the teachings here. You know, we don't have to discover them all completely on our own, which is good, because putting them into practice is hard enough as it is, even with it so well described and so well presented, and so clearly brought into our lives by this Buddha of our age anyway. So, you know, we don't have to actually be concerned about that. Okay, last question. The concepts of non-self and rebirth seem contradictory to me. Can you expand on these topics? What is it that passes from one life to the next if there's no self? It's a classic question. So I guess first, it's good to remember that the concepts of non-self and rebirth, particularly the concept of non-self, is just that. That's a concept, something we talk about and try and put into words. But I actually prefer the translation of anatta as not self, rather than non-self. To me, it seems like a little more descriptive of the process, rather than trying to turn it into a philosophy or some sort of treatise, something to believe in. And the Buddha really never categorically said, there is no self. The whole teaching around anatta and not self, I find it's better to describe it as kind of a strategic contemplation rather than a doctrine that one should understand and believe. That it's best to regard all of the teachings around anatta, not self, as a contemplation that helps one to understand the nature of our experience. So that rather than saying categorically there is no self, the Buddha's teaching is, well, look at everything that we presume to be ourself, and question that, and not just question it up here. You know, it's not just a mental exercise, but it's a deep experiential reflection and investigation based on having a very, very clear, settled mind that's free from the hindrances. So there's a bit of preparatory work. It doesn't mean we can't do these contemplations and considerations before that happens, and sometimes that's a very good way of actually helping to settle the mind, is conceptually thinking about these things. Actually, the investigation and the calming are processes that can happen at the same time, and one supports the other. But to gain a real deep insight into anatta, one needs to have quite a clear, still mind that's not involved in any of the hindrances or darting off and getting lost. That one investigates, again, that presumption of what it is that we normally regard as self. And what we normally regard as self are what the Buddha calls the five aggregates or the five khandhas, body and mind, or in some combination, is what we generally experience as this sense of me or I or mine. The five aggregates being this body, and then the mental aspects, the other four, the mental aspects of feelings and perceptions, mental formations like thinking and emotions, and consciousness itself, either by themselves or in some combination with each other, or taken all five together as a whole, is what we usually regard as myself, or who I am, or at least something that there is something that owns it. And going through systematically and questioning that and looking at that and investigating that is a strategy. It's a contemplative strategy. And the goal of that strategy is to realize what it is that you've normally assumed to be self in some way or another, and kind of teasing that apart and deconstructing that, and seeing what that experience results in. And when one realizes to a very deep extent that body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness are not self in the traditional way that we would define a self as unchanging, solid, under our control, that kind of a thing. You know, when those aspects of what we would normally consider something that applicable to a self don't hold up, then we experience a sense of disenchantment. We're not fooled by that perception any longer. And that sense, that perception of an unchanging, always abiding entity that we would call a self, it just doesn't make any sense anymore. We can't be fooled by the illusion, and we become dispassionate towards those aggregates that we were caught up in thinking as who I am. We turn away from them in a sense, and drop them as something to take refuge in. And the result is this, it's an experience or it's an understanding of not self. But it's not something that we have to believe in or, you know, sign on the dotted line or analyze conceptually. It's something that comes as a conclusion to, it's an experience that comes as a conclusion to this kind of strategic investigation. So that's really, I think, the best way to regard the teaching on anatta, not self. And how it fits in with the idea of rebirth is, well, you know, that gets to be a little complicated, and a lot of times when people would ask the Buddha this question, he basically just wouldn't answer it, because it just gets people too wound up and confused. But essentially, you know, what's reborn, or what moves, you know, what conditions rebirth from lifetime to lifetime when this body passes away? What's reborn, in a sense, are all of our mental tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion, or on the positive side, some of the positive qualities, the paramis that we've developed. Those are mental impulses that just pass on to the next lifetime. You know, there is some reference in the suttas to a form of consciousness called the rebirth consciousness. But I often feel a little hesitant to even talk about that, because then as soon as you start talking about that, people start to solidify that into a material object or a mental object and trying to fix it into place like a soul or a, you know, something like that. But if you think of consciousness as a process rather than as a something, then you can just see, you know, consciousness, you know, the experience of consciousness is a momentary experience in our current life, right here, right now, that is dependent on the previous moment of conditioning. So one moment conditions to the next moment of conscious experience. It's not the same thing. It's not a solid, unchanging entity, but it's a process of awareness and experience that is dependent on what's happened before it, and what we put into it right now conditions what comes afterwards. And to realize, at least for me, it seems pretty clear that there is such a strong momentum of greed, hatred, and delusion that keeps passing on from one moment to the next, that it's hard for me to believe that when this body goes, that momentum just stops and that there is nothing else, and that momentum seeks a position, a place to land, another place to land. And that's what the process of rebirth is, whether it's landing in something in this lifetime, like in another story, another, you know, argument, or you know, another relationship, or whether it's landing in another body when this one is gone. It's all the same process of movement from one moment to the next of these impulses. And it doesn't necessarily have to have the quality of, in fact, it doesn't you know, have the quality of an abiding, unchanging self. Okay. So that's the end of the questions and answers for today. And I'll turn it back over to Ajahn Nyanikul.
Thank you. Jankirtadamo.